welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Jason, WF2N, will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. Also, we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com, and if that doesn't work for you, there's an alternative, live.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information could also be found in our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Jason, WF2N, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Jason, WF2N. Good evening, Jason.
Good evening, this is WF2N, and I'm portable in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn.
Jason, you're sounding wonderful. The repeater seems to be sounding wonderful as well. I'm looking at my waveforms here and don't see the crackles and dropouts, so far so good. Let the net begin. Hopefully there's someone out there who has a question for the technical net this night. So please, if you do, I'll let it drop. Hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name, call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment tonight for the technical net.
I didn't know if I should be the first one or not, but I guess I'm going to be. Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo. I guess I'll wait to give the question, Roy. I do kind of have a question on tube amplifiers again. Something that's been puzzling me. So I guess I'll, when you're ready, come back to me. AC288, back over to that control.
Good job. I'll just ask one more time if anyone wants to go on the list after you. Please give me your first name and your call sign and whether you have a question or a comment. And we'll let it drop for 30 seconds or so and see if there's anyone else who wants to be on the list. And then we'll go to your question.
Joe, KC2, WTA, question and comment.
Good. Joe number 2, WTA, you are second on the list. If anyone else wants to go on to the list, please feel free. Give me your call sign and your first name.
Kilo 2, Oscar Lima. Joe, here supporting the net.
We now have three Joes who've checked into the net. If we have any other Joes who have a question or a comment, or even people not named Joe, feel free. This is the time. Start things out. I will not confuse anyone by calling on Joe first. I will call on AC2AE. AC2AE, what is your question for tonight?
Roy, thanks for coming back to me. Well, I've got a tube amplifier. I've got the Ameritron AL811. And I also have the Ameritron AL80 Alpha. And I noticed the same thing on both amplifiers. I thought maybe it was just a characteristic on one, but they are both Ameritrons, so perhaps it's the amplifier itself, or probably it's the way these tubes react. But I know that when I am on the 80-meter portion of the band compared to the 75-meter portion, being 38 and above, I'm getting two totally different outputs on this amp. When I go down to the 80-meter portion of the band, this amp puts out probably about maybe 350, maybe 400 watts. For some odd reason, when I bring it up to the 75-meter portion of that band, being above 3.800, I can considerably get a lot more wattage by adjusting the plate and the load. Why is that? Now, that's just part of the question. Now, also, when I go to 20 meters, 40 meters, 17, or 10, I start to get a lower output from the amp than what I was getting previously on 80 meters. Well, what the heck is that all about? Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo, back over to Net Control.
Yes, okay. Well, I mean, the problem is that linear amplifiers give an approximate average output specifications. But unfortunately, the nature of linear amplifier has some fluctuations in the gain dependent upon the input frequency that it's called to amplify. Usually the power the gain and the power is greater the lower the amplifier that's designed, unless it's particularly optimized for a higher frequency. So when you have a design that's sort of built for 160 meters and up, you're going to get probably greater gain at those much lower frequencies, and even you'll notice maybe a couple, a dB or so drop just from one end of 80 to the other end that's sometimes called 75. So it's a function of the design circuitry of a given linear amplifier, how sensitive it is to the different frequencies that you're asking it to amplify. It's probably endemic in both designs and in most vacuum tube and in to a degree in solid state. I know that my solid state amplifier kind of gets very cranky when I want it to do something on 6 meters. And it's not as powerful even on 10 meters as when I go down to the lower frequencies.
It's nothing I should be worried about. It's a normal characteristic, and that's what I was wondering, because it was like, now that I see that I have the second amp here, I was saying to myself, you know, this is kind of odd. I've been like really trying to play with it, adjust it, tune it just right, and I guess I get this thing, I've got it working correctly. All right, Roy, thank you very much for that answer.
Thank you much, Joe, and come back again when we do this over again. Joe number 2, KC2WTA, you had a question and a comment. I leave it up to you which you want to do first.
Okay, Roy, it's good to be back on the TechNet. I was away for a while, and I was off high frequency for a while, but I'm back. And I'll start my comment. It's basically an update on the all EFKIT high frequency station that I was building. I was having a lot of problems with the bulkhead entrance. I was using a piece of quarter-inch plexiglass, and that just wasn't strong enough to support the bus bar and have the all the cable leads coming into it. So I removed that and replaced it with a piece of half-inch high-density polyethylene. And I did that on Sunday, and between Sunday and now, I was able to get my RF ground complete, and it came very well. I'll drop. And so I can continue on the high frequency station. The station is going to be composed of all Heathkit. It has an SB-102, which is the high frequency transceiver, and an SB-640, which is a 6 meter transceiver, SB-200, which is the 500 watt linear amp, and a lot of the accessories like a monitor scope, pan adapter, and frequency counter. And I have an HW-12 monobander 80 meter, which was converted to 160 meters. And for 2 meters, I'll be using a VF-7401, which is the Heathkit's synthesized transceiver. And basically, I'm to the point where I have to start buying more cabling for it. I'll drop. The operating position that I'm in now, I was using exclusively LMR 400. And on my dipoles, I was using LMR 240 because the LMR 400 was very heavy and it was hauling the dipole down into a heavy V-shape. So I went over to LMR 240. So that's basically the end of the comment. The question is, does anybody know what's the maximum power you could run through LMR 240? Back to you, Roy.
C2GS. Well, it's rated to about 1,500 watts at 30 megahertz, so that shouldn't be a problem. The slight downside is it has a greater attenuation loss per 100 feet, so you'll have more power turns into waste heat. Not a great deal as long as you keep it to the lower frequencies, but that's the only problem that I see going from a LMR 400 to an LMR 240. I did have a question, though. I think you mentioned that your radio is an SB-201?
No, it's SB-102. That's their high-frequency transceiver from 80 to 10 meters.
I misheard you because, as you mentioned, the 201 is part of the line of the linear amplifiers. It's a very popular one. You still, to this day, will see articles about people who did conversions to it and all kinds of trick it out. And, the SB-201 is a classic design for a linear amplifier. So I just got the number, I guess, mixed up.
Actually, I have the SB-200. I forget what the difference is between the SB-200 and the SB-201. One of them has another band that the other doesn't have. And, I have three of those. One is going to remain high frequency, and another one is going to be converted to a 6 meter. 6 meters to work with the SB-640 6 meter transceiver. That's what's going on here. KC2 WETA.
Good. It sounds like you have this well planned out, and I wish you a great deal of good luck. I don't know. I have looked around 6 meters every so often, but it's even more sparse than 10 meters. I'm there every Sunday morning for the Kings County Radio Club 10 meter net, but 6 meters is even more empty than 10 meters, so I wish you good luck. I know when the sunspots start to get active again, 6 meters will no doubt liven up and give you a great deal of enjoyment. It's called the Magic Band, and so I wish you luck with it. But hopefully I got across the idea that the LMR 240 power handling should suffice you. Its maximum rating is about 1,500 watts. So it's all doable. I wish you luck. Was this routed through a wall or through a window pane that you put the PVC on?
Yeah, I took a sash out of a cellar window, and I used a piece of quarter-inch plexiglass because I wanted it to still function as a window and let a lot of light in, but it just wasn't strong enough to support the heavy bus bar that the lightning arresters will be mounted on. And I wanted to go up to a half inch, but a half inch piece of plexiglass, and that, for that size, 14 by 30 inches, was $80. That was the best I could do. So I got high density polyethylene, which is basically what milk cartons are made out of today. And a half inch piece of that cost $35. And it's, per given size, it's much more forgiving than plexiglass. Plexiglass is a little brittle. I had, wherever I drilled a hole, there were stress fractures starting to radiate out from the holes. And so, and the high-density polyethylene, even at a half inch, is still translucent. Not transparent, but translucent. Does let some light come in. And now the big job begins. I'm going to drop. So far, I've done the fit-up on the entire RF ground, including the interior bus bar and the flat strap leading out to the exterior bus bar, and going on to three ground rods that I have driven. And I'm going to have to undo all of that and polish it up with Scotch-Brite and apply conductive anti-corrosion paste, and then tighten it all up again. Then I can move my Kenwood TS-430S, which I use on high frequency, into the new location as a the high frequency rig in there, as I start working on all of the HIFKIT apparatus. So KC2 WTA.
2GS. Well, that sounds great. It sounds like you're going to have a load of fun setting all that up. I used one of those MFJ through the window pieces of wood with barrel connectors screwed through them, but I found that I had so much weight, because most of my coaxes tend to be LMR 400s, but there was so much weight of kind of pressing them and torquing them that the connections got a little wobbly. So I traded that in for just basically a big piece of wood with some holes drilled through them, with the coaxial cables that run through the holes, and some weathering putty to seal out the winter from them. And knock on wood, it seems to be working for me. But sounds like a great idea on your part. I don't have my bus bar connected at the window. I have it separate about a foot or so away from on the wall right below the window. So because those things, yeah, as you mentioned, they're rather chunky. I have a big sheet of copper with holes in it that I can bolt things and ground them to it. So I thought it would be more secure for me to put it in a wall than to put it in that window pane feed through, because you put a little bit too much strain on those things and they tend to give unless you're really screw them together so that you can't do anything with the window. But good luck with that, and hopefully you'll come back and tell us how it develops over time.
Roy, this is KC2WT. I'm on the side.
Thank you, Joe, for coming and participating tonight. Once again, I am Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, Roy. I'm the net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club's technical net, which we meet here every second and fourth Wednesday of each month from 9 p.m. And go for as long as need be. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics or what have you, please hit the push-to-talk button and give us your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment for the technical net. Okay, seems to be a little bit of a quiet stretch. Let me tell you a bedtime story of a technical nature, and hopefully it'll entertain and inform you. Because I've in the past rambled on about dipoles and Yagis, so I thought I'd do something ever so slightly different. We'll start the same place that we started at the very beginning, with a dipole in space. Half a wavelength in length, two legs, each a quarter of a wavelength for the resonant frequency you're interested in. And if you have a half-wave dipole in free space, the nominal radiation resistance, otherwise known to us as impedance, for such a device is about 73 ohms, give or take. So there's something interesting that you could do with that dipole in space. You can basically take one of the legs away. If you do that, it's not going to really be terribly good as an antenna, but there's a trick in the universe. The same way that mirrors work. If you take a 6-inch ruler and you put it up against a mirror, it looks like there's another 6 inches behind the mirror. So actually, physics works sort of the same way when it comes to the waves, because radio waves and light waves are both electromagnetic waves. So the idea is you put a conducting plane like a mirror at the end of one leg of a monopole, half a dipole, and the reflection actually works rather well. You fool the universe into thinking that you have a dipole, and you can get on the air and use that. But you know, how many people have an infinitely long sheet of conducting metal? Not many people. You can fool the universe even farther, because at radio frequencies, radio waves can't really discern whether you have a continuous sheet of metal or whether you just have a couple little pieces of metal. And so you can trade in that long sheet of conducting metal and just trade it in for just a couple of radials. Now, if you use one radial, it'll work, but your signal will be kind of going in the direction where your radial is going at. The radials go at a right angle to the antenna itself. And if you put a radio on below that, on the other side, then you'll have the signal going where the two radials are, and not too much at right angles where the radials aren't. So the smallest number of radials you can sort of get away with, you want a nice omnidirectional signal, is three. So you put three at regular intervals, about 160 degrees, 180 degrees, yeah. 120 degrees, yeah, 120 degrees, and you have basically a quarter wave antenna with three radials, you know, oriented in the vertical, and you have a vertical ground plane, which everyone knows and loves. The problem with a vertical ground plane is a few things. Since you started with a dipole that had about a impedance of 73 ohms, nature doesn't really allow you to trick it too much, so it'll only give you an impedance of 36 ohms. So now, instead of that wonderful 50 ohms that you really like, you have to deal with 36. Fortunately, the closer you get it down to the ground, and the more you kind of tilt the radials downward, the higher the impedance goes. So it's not too difficult to tweak a resonant quarter wave ground plane into 50 ohms of impedance. Let me drop for a sec. Now, as long as you keep the vertical quarter wave ground plane antenna away from the Earth, from Earth ground, by a half a wavelength or more, it should work fine. And that's the basic principle of why all these quarter wave ground plane UHF, VHF antennas that we know and love work so well, because no one puts them on the ground. We all put them as high as we can. You can't put a vertical on the ground. The only problem with that is if you put it close enough to the ground, it will couple with the ground, and a lot of your RF, rather than radiating off of your antenna, will get soaked up into the earth and warm up all those earthworms and other creatures that are in your soil. And that's wasted power. So the way to get around that is by increasing the number of radials that you use on your ground. Effectively, what you're doing is you're shielding your antenna from ground loss. That's where those three radials usually have to grow to something along the number of 30 or 36 radials in order to get proper shielding to diminish the ground losses, ground coupling, and get most of your RF to radiate off of your antenna into the sky. That'll give you a good omnidirectional antenna, has a nice takeoff angle for the most part, and if you can't get your quarter wave if you can't get a quarter wave antenna, if it's just too long mechanically for you to accomplish that in your environment, you can always make it mechanically shorter as long as you lengthen it electronically. You can do that a number of different ways. You can put a coil. You can put a coil in the base, which is very popular as a mobile antenna. You can put a coil in the middle. You can even put a coil on the top. It starts to become a mechanical problem if you put the coil in the top, because coils have more mass, they take up more weight, and they tend to deform simple vertical antennas. So most vertical antennas that are loaded with coils are base loaded. Sometimes they're middle loaded. You can also put on something called a capacitive hat. This is a length of wire that some people might misconstrue as an upside down radial, but unlike a radial, which is not connected to the radiating antenna wire, a capacitive hat is connected to the tip of the top of the vertical antenna and adds an electronic length to it, making it resonant, making it 50 ohms and able to transmit a very good signal. So that's a short discussion of how a quarter wave of ground plane verticals tend to work. Anyone have any questions or comments about this subject? Okay, I guess no comments. I will ask once again if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for tonight. And if not, we'll move on to the TechNet puzzle, which is available on our website, or you can just go into your browser and type puzzle.kc2rc.com. So once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra Roy with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any other questions or topics or comments or what have you of a technical nature, feel free to hit that push-to-talk button. We'll move on then to the TechNet puzzle for this time. Unfortunately, it's one that has an illustration. So it has it demonstrates four different impedance matching circuits. And it asks the question, which one of these circuits is a T network? So hopefully someone has looked up the web page, sees the question, and would anyone like to hazard a guess of which of those is a T network?
Ooh, pick me, EC2, AE.
You're picked.
Okay, it's probably one of my favorite letters since it's in my call sign twice. So I'm going to go with the number of the letter A for alpha.
Absolutely, positively correct. Congratulations. As long as you understand the naming convention to impedance matching circuits, it's really not that too difficult. The reason why there are such things as T's and L's and pi impedance matching networks is because if you sort of draw a stick diagram of the active components, whether they're in series or parallel, They tend to look like T's and L's and pi's. And so if you look at the four choices that are listed on the page, the first one, as Joe AC2AE mentioned, is a T network. B is a pi network. And actually, C is a pi network as well. And D is an L network. Now, for extra bonus point question, B and C are both pi networks, but they look a little bit different. Anyone want to hazard a guess how it's sort of described that difference?
I am actually going back to it right now. Give me one moment. AC2AE.
Both circuits going across with a capacitor shunted at the beginning and shunted at the end. That's a parallel parallel pi network. If you have an open line or something that's a balanced type of a network, you tend to want a parallel impedance tuning. If you have an unbalanced network, like coaxes we all have, you settle for choice C, which is an unbalanced pi network. So that's just the difference. One's balanced, the other one's unbalanced. But the naming designation, as I said, is just the stick diagram of the active components, which amount to capacitors and inductors. So, as AC2AE said, the answer for tonight's puzzle is A. A is a T network. Thanks, Joe, for participating.
Welcome, Mr. Roy. Anytime. So, Roy, what did you say that the D was, the very last one? Because I thought it was, you know, now that I'm looking at it again, I see that it's an inductor on the top instead of a resistor. But if it was a resistor, that would be a bandpass filter, wouldn't it?
Bandpass filter, it wouldn't be an impedance matching filter. The impedance matching circuit of D is designated an L match, which is an incredibly common form of matching circuit. Most antenna tuners made these days, especially the auto tuners that run on relays, operate as L networks. And that's a nice little example of an L network. They tend to be a little bit less expensive because they need less components. Because they have less components, they tend to be slightly more efficient, but they don't match as many different impedances as either a T or a pi network does.
Okay, see, that was my next question. All right. So the T network would be the better one, but the more common used is the D. All right, which kind of makes sense. You know, it's less expensive, and there's a lot of cheap hams out there. AC2AE.
Definitely, you have to go back to Johnson Viking and companies back in the 50s to get a really nice balanced pi network type of configuration, because those even have more components. It has an inductor on either side, and it has a pair of capacitor on either side, so that's even probably more expensive. So PAL stars tend to be more in the type of as T impedance matching circuits, and LDG and MFJ and such are pretty much all L networks.
Interesting. I actually recall about a year or so on one of the nets that you had told us that you had a Palomar, and it was a T network. I don't know if it was the net or maybe even one of the meetings, but I remember that you had mentioned that. Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Echo.
I have two PAL stars. I have a HF Auto, which is a auto tuning, which unfortunately I've had to send back at least about two or three times. Hopefully three's the charm. And I have a manual AT2KD PALSTAR that I have hooked up to my my secondary antenna system, so that when, especially on Sunday mornings when I'm doing diversity reception, I have my auto tuner set up to my stereo vertical, and I have my manual tuner set up on my fan dipole. So the best of both worlds. When I'm feeling inclined to twirl knobs and dial things in, I have my manual. When I just want to just have the machine do it for me, I have my auto tuner.
I pretty much use the auto, well, I have no choice but to use the auto tuner now. I just have this one at the moment. But I've got the MFJ 998, and it seems to be really good. I mean, I haven't had an issue with this thing at all. Let's knock on wood. And it's been great for me. I've used it well over 1,000 watts. I'm using it now with about maybe 600 watts, and it's always run pretty good. And I guess it is running on the, what is it, the L network, AC2, maybe.
It's a very good auto tuner. I actually have mine right now. It's in the closet. When the PALSTAR Auto had to go back to the manufacturer, I pulled out the MFJ, plugged it in, and it worked like a charm. It's not quite as broad as far as tuning things. You know, sometimes I'll joke that I could tune up a doorknob on the PALSTAR, but it's a very serviceable, and it certainly will take all the watts you throw at it. So it's a fine piece of kit.
I noticed with this particular tuner that if you set it to tune to a 1 to 0 in the menu settings, it'll have a hard time getting there on every band. It'll take like a good maybe like 30, maybe 35 seconds to actually tune, which when you hear all those relays clicking and switching, it kind of gets you a little nervous, even when you're only putting in about 10 watts into it to tune it up. But I noticed that when I set the menu to like a 1 to 1, it tunes a heck of a lot quicker. And I'm happier with a 1 to 1 than a 1 to 0, just in the immediate way that it tunes. There's also a memory setting on here where it remembers each band that it's on. Me, I keep that off. I don't particularly like that. You know, antennas stretch out, the wind comes, you know, everything changes a little bit. So I always like to get a nice, good tune on it. AC2, AE, back over to net.
I could understand that. The HF Auto has a memory feature. As a matter of fact, I can just tell it what frequency my radio's on, and it'll track it and tune it up for that. And if it's off a little bit, then it just kind of fine-tunes things, which is fine by me. What you mentioned about the tuner, could you repeat it one time?
With what, like setting the, in the menu features, setting, having it set to tune to a 1 to 1 opposed to a 1 to 0? Is that what you're referring to?
I just wanted to make the point that I realize the joy of having 1 to 1. But in reality, 1 to 1 isn't incredibly better than 1.1 to 1. And a lot of people kind of learn that the hard way. The amount of return loss that you create because of transmission line loss of reflection, because rather than having a 1 to 1, you have a 1.1 to 1, is minimal, is negligible. And so if your system is tuned up to 1.1 or 1.2 even, or, you know, 1.3, it's not a calamity. And the better the wiggle room you give your antenna tuner, the easier it will be to find a match, and the faster it will find the match. So it's always, generally, my understanding is suggested not to try and set it to the best possible VisWa humanly capable. I mean, There are people out there who will certainly tune up manually their device for as close to one-to-one as they want. So that's fine. But when you kind of setting the autopilot to do that, you're probably best to keep it a little bit of wiggle room. You know, set it at 1.2 or something. And that usually works beautifully.
I'm actually in agreement with you on that one. Ever since I made that change to the setting, the amplifier plays a heck of a lot more nicer with the radio and the antenna. I noticed that there's not as much reflective power, so you would think that there's more coming back, but there really isn't. AC2, AE.
Diminishing return. I mean, I understand why people just like big numbers, and so, if you give a person a choice of whether they would pay $100 more, say, to go from something with a 6 dB gain to 7 dB gain, you're going to find a significant number of people who will pay $100 more for that 1 dB. If you then sit them down and explain to them that you have to get an increase of at least 6 dB for one S unit, so you can imagine what 1 dB does for your S meter, give or take, that they kind of lose the desire to put down their credit card for an extra $100. So, you know, decibels, power outputs, you know, bigger is always better, but sometimes it's a degree, it's diminishing returns, especially when it comes to viswas that, you know, not terrible. I mean, I wouldn't suggest to anyone that they try and transmit with a viswa of 2 or 3. But when it gets down to things like 1.2, it's remarkably how negligible the difference is.
Well, you know, I really, me personally, I mean, this is just my opinion, and I believe it's like every, what is it, after 600 watts, you need 1,000 for every single, for every one decibel gain when you're using an amplifier. So in my honest opinion, anything over 600, I'll even give you guys 1,500, you know, we'll just say 1,600 for argument's sake. Anything after that's a waste. I mean, where are you trying to get to?
And if you were interested in, say, a single S unit of increase, you would have to take your 1,500 watts and put it through a really illegal amplifier and pull out 6,000 watts to get one S unit improvement. So when you're talking about 20 watts, okay, going from 20 watts to 80 watts will give you one S unit. That's doable. But in things like 1,500 watts to go to 6,000 watts, you know, at that point, all your neighbors are going to be knocking on your door because their toasters are receiving your signal.
So I was telling a funny story. Well, not really a funny story. It's kind of an illegal story, but this was way back when. I'm sure the statute of limitations are way over on it. But back in the day when I was a CBer, had to be around like the mid to late 80s, I had a very large amplifier in my house, and a very nice-looking lady had moved in across the street. All the guys in the neighborhood were drooling off of her, and she used to wear a nice little skimpy bikini in her pool. So we were all, you know, going nuts for her. And one day, she came knocking on my door, and, you know, my heart, I was 17, my heart dropped. I was like, oh, my God, you know, what's she doing here? And she just goes to me, she goes, "Do you have a CB radio?" She goes to me. And I was like, so, you know, right away, I'm like, yeah, I got a CB. She goes, "Well," she goes, "I want you to listen to this." Roy, she played a message from her answering machine. This was a cassette from her answering machine. Every time that I would key my microphone up, my radio, my whole unit, it would automatically turn on her answering machine and start recording me. And I was having a argument with somebody at the moment on the CB radio, and it was undoubtedly my voice. You know, there was just no denying it. So, yeah, I had a lot of problems with amplifiers back in the day. AC2, AE. And, you know, it was probably because, you know, it was probably the amplifier was all right. It was probably that darn CB radio that was just such a mess, the signal going into it, that was so sloppy and dirty, but and unfiltered. But who knows? AC2 AE, back over the net.
Yes. Yeah, it could be the Radiohead harmonics that the linear amplifier was amplifying. It's just as likely the linear amplifier was not perfectly linear, and there was introducing harmonic distortions into it. I've heard people tell stories of their voice showing up on FM radio receivers. I've heard a lot of stories of guys who found that on one particular band, when they hit that push-to-talk button, their burglar alarm system would go off on them. So there's no guessing of what kind of RF could get into different things. The best bet is to keep your radiating antennas as far away from other human beings as humanly possible, and to try and keep the amount of nonlinear distortions to a minimum. We had a, unfortunately, problem with 10 meters last summer. A CB'er's linear amplifier was particularly filthy, to the point where he was talking on 11 meters, because I was watching him talk on 11 meters, and he had so much harmonics going on that one of his many side signals went up to 28.380, and we had to hear a distorted version of him there. Fortunately, I've heard him on CB since then without that distortion, so either he's changed frequencies and is annoying another person on 10-meter band, or he swapped it out or fixed that radio. So, but yeah, we all have those stories. Fortunately, we should consider ourselves very fortunate that we live in the age of cable television and satellite television, because that has taken a lot of RF off of our environment and decreased our chances of annoying our neighbors. I knock on wood, I haven't gotten knocked on the door and people saying things that they said to you. And since it's up on my roof and no one looks up in the general direction, probably no one even knows there's a ham radio here. So I'm just hoping it continues that way.
Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Echo. Yeah, you know, even at low wattages, or lower wattages, like Jason KD2LRX, before he was before his antenna was outside, he used to put it on his air conditioner. His antenna is still on his air conditioner, but it's about maybe 10 feet higher now on a mast. But he used to have like a little mag mount and put it on his air conditioner. And the way the building was shaped, you can see the hallway. Right across from his window. It was like maybe 5 feet, maybe 6 feet across. And that was like the hallway to get up to his place. And in that hallway was a fire alarm or a smoke alarm or something like that. One of those maybe carbon detectors or whatever, carbon monoxide detectors. And every time that he would transmit, he would set that thing off. And it got to the point where I had to go there and, you know, we had to figure out a way of getting the antenna away from there and up in the air, which we were actually very successful. But he was setting it off at 50 watts. He was setting it off at 25 watts. When he would go down to 5, I believe he was pretty much okay. And it was maybe, I would say, a good maybe 15 feet away from it. But, yeah, RF man can get in the weirdest places. You'd never know. Listen, I've had stray wires pick up. I'm talking like just like literally stray, coax cable wires picking up interference that I've had to clip. So and put our RF beads on. So anything could really pick it up. AC280.
Yes, yeah, just about anything. There's all kinds of reasons for it. One is if you have a mismatch and you have reflection back in common mode. RF can get all over your system. I've seen it reboot people's computers and do all kinds of very strange things. At one point, before I was able to lift my fan dipoles to a decent angle, I suffered a great deal of RF that just got reflected right back into the shaft, and it would wreak havoc with my computer, which is, you know, covered with a metallic case, so it's not like it's in plastic or anything. But once I was able to lift the legs of my dipole so that they made a little bit better than a 45-degree angle with each other, so about 90 degrees, that all went away, thankfully. So if you got a tuned antenna, or if your antenna is too close and you're anywhere close to the near field, then it's going to be a very big problem to solve. You know, I feel sorry for the guys that have their antennas inside their houses because they simply can't come up with a good way of doing it outside. That's very difficult to keep the area clean of reflecting RF and such.
You know, Jason, KD2LRX also tried an indoor antenna, and we winded up going with an inverted L outside of his apartment in a tree. But, when we had it, we had a 1 to 9 with, I believe it was 53 to 54 feet of line. And it was working. We were receiving. We were transmitting, but it was completely shutting his TV off. I mean, cutting the power on it and everything. I mean, we turned it on, shut it off. When we reduced the power, even at like 5 watts, it was destroying it. And the bad thing was, on the opposite side of that wall was his neighbor's television, so we could only imagine what was happening over there. So we had to definitely stop that project, and that's when we decided to rearrange it for another day and do it outside.
Outdoor antennas are much, 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 much better than indoor antennas. But, you know, any port in the storm, as the old saying goes. And one of the other little problems is if you have a reflecting mismatched antenna on the outside, you can put a ferrite strap over it, the bead or core or what have you, because it's most likely reflecting in the common mode. If you have an antenna in your room, there's nothing much you can do. Ferrite's wonderful, but it's not a panacea. You sort of actually have to build a Faraday cage around anything that you particularly want to shield from those RF. And that's very difficult with a television set because you sort of actually want to watch it. You know, having it inside a metal box with no holes in it kind of makes it not the greatest television in the world. So, yeah, some people get away with murder, if you will. They staple a piece of wire on the wall next to their shack on the inside, and they talk to the world. I also knew of guys who put a coax on the ground outside their backyard and talk to the world. But most of us have to deal with the actual law of physics, and it's problematic either with indoor antennas or antennas that are lying on the ground. I'm glad to hear that the final result is that Jason has a better antenna working for him on the outside.
Yeah, he's got an antenna definitely working for him. And, getting back to what you said, I did have issues with my computer, too. I had to put the ferrite beads on all the USB inputs on there. It was knocking out certain, I have a USB dongle for my pan adapter. So it was knocking that completely out. It was knocking my mouse out. So once I put the ferrite beads on, I actually put ferrite beads across the board, man. I did it from the power cable to the monitors to everything, and that pretty much took care of that. What else was I going to say? Oh, man, you cover a lot of topics in that one. But, also with the ferrite beads, you've got to choke everything off, man. I mean, that's really it. When you, I've got quite a few antennas up there now. I've got three antennas, and they're not really all close together, but they're all within maybe like 30 or 40 feet from each other, because I'm very limited on where I can put them on the roof. But I do feel for everybody, you know, like even me, I'm allowed to put them on the roof, and, you know, it's still very hard for me to put up what I would really like. I can't have my antenna in a 45-degree angle. There's just no room for it. I can't really go any higher with another mast. And what else was it? Oh, and speaking of people who get lucky and can use a wire right next to them, I spoke to somebody last night. He stripped 19 inches of wire from the coax and let the negative end of it hang. And I was talking to him in 2 meters. He was in Staten Island on the simplex frequency. So, yeah, it's like it's whatever works. And he hadn't gotten on the radio in a long time. He didn't have an antenna. And that's what he remembered to do. So, you know, when you want to get on the air, you'll get on the air. When I first got on the air, what I used to do was I used to throw a wire over my fire escape inside of a PVC tube. And it was kind of like a fishing pole going over my balcony, about a good maybe 2 or 3 feet. And I used to have a fishing weight on it, and it used to go all the way down to the ground. And I used to just pull it in and pull it all the way up, and then just slide it back in at the end of the night. And I worked everywhere from 20 meters all the way up to 10 meters on that thing without a problem. AC2, AE.
Yes. Well, you know, like I said, any port in a storm. If it works, I always tell people, don't question success. Always question failure, because you'll learn something and you'll get it better the next time. But never question success. So whatever worked for you, worked for you. It sounds like that guy that you talked about kind of put together a kind of a mini Zeppelin antenna, because that's sort of the basic structure of a Zeppelin antenna, where you cut away the coaxial cable and you use the center element as the antenna proper, and you use the shield of the coax cable as the counterpoise. And it's very effective. It worked on the Zeppelins and such, so I'm not surprised that it worked for him as well. One of the things that I keep telling people to try and consider is if they're going to set up computers in their shack, try and make the USB cables as short as they need to be. Don't get very generous with long lengths of USB cable all over the place, because the longer the length of these cables are, the more likely you're going to need more common mode traps for them, toroids and such. So, you know, try and keep them optimally length, and some of them actually come with their own built-in toroids. So, you know, whatever works for you. Wrap up especially those things that are kind of iffy. I haven't done it on everyone, but when one or two of my devices blinks as I'm transmitting 800 plus watts, I then take a ferrite and wrap it around, and it goes away. So, you know, You learn to live with what you got. But in general speaking, everyone or anyone out there, if you're putting together a computer system for your shack and you're sensitive about RF, keep USB cables relatively short. But Charlie Two Golf Sierra, we've gone an actual hour, which is very nice. If anyone has any other questions or comments or topics, now's the time. If you're so inclined, just hit that push-to-talk button and give me your call sign and your first name.
This is Kilo Quebec, Zero Quebec. KQ Zero Q.
Trying to go through digital, I think.
Shut it off. I forgot to shut it down. It's down now. Go ahead. You're good.
Gotcha. Once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra Roy, net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m. And we've been doing this for an hour now or so. So I'm just asking before we shut this all down for this week, if anyone else has any questions or comments or topics or statements of a technical nature, all you have to do is hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Well, this net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an RRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be December 4th, which will be our annual holiday party. All members that have paid up for 2020 membership will have free admission that night. All others will be asked to pay a nominal $5 apiece. We also offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session, much like this net, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. as time allows. Our regular general meeting usually begins at 8 p.m. and continues anywhere from about 9 to 10 o'clock, depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter net every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater. If you can communicate using Fusion technology, please join in. We offer an audio stream of the Fusion net on the internet, as well as all audio transmissions on our club repeater at stream.kc2rc.com. And we have links for DMR and for DSTAR that are explained on our website. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the host of Technical Net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com, www.kc2rc.com. which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Alien Web Hosting, who we would like to thank once again. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. It's time to roll this all up and shut this all down, but we'll be back to do it all over again November 27th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks, as always, to the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host, Jason, WF2N. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, and I'll be going clear and getting the heck out of here. Until next time, guys, see ya.
Net man, thank you so much, and I especially like the topic that you had, the question. That was pretty awesome as well. Thanks a lot, AC2AE.
For KC2WTA 73.